Well, hi, folks. Welcome to another edition of the Survival Podcast, and we are live with episode 3675 today. It is Wednesday. That means, as usual for a Wednesday, we have an interview lined up. We have Sean and Jen Hawkins will be on with us in just a bit. We're going to be talking about mushrooms. Now, we just talked about mushrooms with Olga from Mushroom Mountain, and I'm trying to do more on that, so I don't think this is actually related to their app coming in. It just worked out that way, which is serendipitous. We're going to be talking about using mushrooms today to heal the health of soil and to heal the health of humans. And we'll start with that as soon as we bring them on. Before that, real quick, let us go ahead and take a moment to thank our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is KnifeKits.com. If you check out KnifeKits.com, you'll see that anybody, even someone like me, can build a knife with the help of KnifeKits.com. It's exactly what it sounds like. You get a kit, and it is designed for you to be then able to fabricate it into a knife. They have all kinds of awesome choices for handle material as well. They also have everything you need to make sheets, whether they're leather or kydex, or holsters, whether they're leather or kydex. And they're just a really cool company. It's been around for a very long time, longer than us, but they've been with us for almost as long as we've been here. They're one of the first sponsors we ever signed, and here we are 17 years down the road, and they're still sponsoring the show. Check them out today at KnifeKits.com. Next up today, USABerkeyFilters.com. Jeff the Berkey Guy Gleason's another guy. He's been with us, you know, on and off a couple times, but for a very long time, I would say at least 15 years of supporting the show. So if you're going to get a Berkey, don't get it from some guy at a gun show that started selling Berkeys last week. Get it from the original, the real Berkey guy, and you can find him at USABerkeyFilters.com. Water is life. It's incredibly important that you drink the best water you can. And one thing I always tell people to think about with water filtration is this. You know how sometimes you hear on the news, hey, you know, we have a boil water advisory for this area now. And when that happens, 9 times out of 10, they don't know there's a problem until people start showing up sick, which means you've already been drinking the bad water for who knows how long. And maybe, fortunately, you haven't gotten sick yourself yet. That's just one reason to make sure you're filtering your water. So check out USA Berkey Filters and deal with Jeff, the original Berkey Guy Gleason. With that, I want to welcome Jen and Sean to the Survival Podcast.
Hey, Jack, how's it going?
Hi.
Glad to have you both here today. Can we start out with like a little bit about what you guys do today and how you got into it without digging into the topic itself? Just kind of your backstory, like, what do you do professionally? Is that what you've always done? And if not, what brought you here?
So I've been working in horticulture for, I guess, 15 years or so. You know, I started with hydroponics, got into microgreens and worked in some facilities. And then I got into soil, started studying soil science and Korean natural farming and did some Jadam. And this sort of led to fungus in the end, because the fungus is extremely important to your soil. And then as you start learning more about this ever expansive world of mushrooms, you start to learn that they're also really helpful medicines as well. So it all just sort of is one big cohesive unit, you know, all is one. And the soil health led me to finding health with mushrooms and led me to gin, actually, as well. But, yeah, Jen has an interesting story, too, where both of our backgrounds sort of ended up meshing together, even though they're on opposite spectrums of the industry. So can you talk about your background?
Yeah. So I come from, actually, a compounding pharmaceutical background. I was working for, actually, it's the largest compounding company in America. And it's not just in America. It's all over the world. And I started feeling really guilty. I was working in customer service, and then I ended up working in sales. And once you get into sales, you go to a different, meeting than everybody else goes to. And then you learn all these things that you're not supposed to know, and you start feeling bad. And I ended up quitting my job. So.
Yeah. And her background in pharmacy stuff really helped us build the company. learning how to formulate the mushrooms into their specific weights and particle sizes, and then getting things into capsules properly. There's actually this huge skill set involved in actually taking the raw mushroom and turning it into a usable medicine. It can be kind of a mess, and without her help, I don't think I'd be able to do it.
That's the right training from the wrong source sometimes is the thing. I know that my wife has similar feelings about her 20-plus years as a nurse, and specifically a pediatric nurse, and giving vaccinations that entire period of time. And, you know, I know a lot of people think we're anti-vax, we're not, but we're also like, maybe there's a lot of things that we don't need to be doing to kids, especially, like, the week they're born, you know, like, things like that. Anyway, I know you guys...
Day one.
What's that?
So who needs Hep B on day one?
That's my number one question. Like, no doctor has ever answered it in any way that makes any sense.
Yeah.
You know, well, their mother could be at risk. So if their mother's at risk, then maybe you do it. But like, yeah, okay, sure. Because I haven't seen many one-day-olds out using intravenous drugs or having sex.
Right.
Like, I just haven't seen that. And I'm not thinking it happens very often. So maybe we don't need to be doing this.
Right.
There's a lot of things we can kick inside the medical and pharmaceutical industries, but I know that COVID had a big impact on your outlook on life. And even though we're way past it, there is still some propensity by YouTube Nazis to make videos go away and punish creators. So let's be a little bit careful with what we say about certain medications or whatever. But the overriding way that it was handled, how did that change, like, you guys, your view of the world as a whole?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was probably the culminating moment for me understanding that there's a lot more going on around us and people are a little more susceptible to propaganda than I thought, and how easy it was to put people into a state of fear and really just completely change the relationships around you. I lost friends, I lost family, and, you know, it really opened my eyes to alternatives as well. I won't get into any of the details, but it really sort of helped me branch into this. It helped me start thinking about what natural medicine can I find in my area? What can I grow? What's in my backyard? I started learning the different plant species that were growing in my yard. And sure enough, you know, several of them are anti-inflammatory, you know, and they're all around you. So it helped to sort of get me out of that box of just living my life and just going through all the motions to understanding what can I do to take control of myself so that the things like lockdowns, the things like forced mandates don't actually have an effect on my life. And that's really what we've done. We've started building our lives so that if anything like that ever happens again, it's not really going to affect us. We have the communities, we have the business, we have the friendships and the relationships around us that would completely make all that obsolete now. You know, and it was a hard time at first, but what's come from it, I think, has just been wonderful. And a lot of people, I think, have come to this realization, and there's a lot of awakening that's happened since then. And honestly, this business probably wouldn't exist without that happening. So, you know, you have to take the good and the bad. And, yeah, it's wonderful to be on the other side of it and see what's come from it and the relationships and the community that's really building around it because of it. It was a difficult catalyst, but I think a necessary one.
And for myself, I feel like it was the turning point because I had just quit my job at the pharmaceutical company and I had been working for my brother for about 8 months. And all of these things started happening and I was already sort of awakened to what was going on, what was really going on. And that's why I quit my job. And then it was like things just continued. It was like a domino effect. It just continued to be exposed. And it honestly prepared me for meeting Sean because if I would have met him like 2 years before, we were like not on the same page at all. And I was still indoctrinated into Western medicine and I was still in love with my pharmaceuticals and It prepared me, for sure, for him.
Should have been like, who is this hippie over here?
Yes.
Like, walking around the woods, picking plants.
Yeah, like he's crazy. And at first, even though it had began, it was even kind of, he still caught me off guard because it was very different than what I'm used to. My mother is also a nurse. And so it's a lot. It's a lot of change, but it was necessary.
Yeah, I can understand that. For me, I think one of the big things that changed for me is it ruined one of my guilty pleasures, which are nighttime medical drama shows. This brilliant doctor with this person with this weird disease, and you know, like House was based on Sherlock.
Yeah.
Now they have a new show called Watson, and it's kind of from the same producers and unrelated to House. But you know, you get this vision of like, you know, if you're really, really sick with something weird, like all these doctors are working on figuring out how do we cure this one person. And, like, you're like, okay, so we have all these options, and doctors were, like, en masse forbidden to attempt to use them.
Yeah.
Let's not worry about claiming whether they worked or not. Like, benign, non-harmful, the worst case scenario is it will do nothing. And people had their medical licenses threatened for it. One of my listeners, for instance, told me that they ended up dehydrated when they had COVID. So there's a very simple treatment for dehydration. It's called IV fluids. Like anybody knows, like EMTs that come out and they think this person might be dehydrated, on the way to the hospital, they're giving them fluids. It's that easy.
Yeah.
He was an EMT, and he went to the ER that he worked out of, and he had to go three times before they'd give him fluids because they said fluids were not a treatment for COVID. Well, they're not, but they are a treatment for dehydration.
Right.
It was like once you had COVID, then every other sensible thing went out the window. So my wife actually ended up the same thing, dehydrated while she had COVID because she couldn't swallow well enough. Mm. We called up a hydration company that comes to your house. They were here 30 minutes after we made the call, and the guy was gone 15 minutes after he got here. And she was instantly able to sleep, rest, and recover, and she pretty much was on the up. We would have spent 6-8 hours in an ER begging for them to just give fluids, which is why we didn't go. And it cost us a fraction to have somebody personally come to the house. So for me, like, it just blew up everything I ever believed. Even though I had problems with pharmaceutical claims, like I hate pharmaceutical ads. I've been beating that crap up since the 80s remix jingles, the fat people dancing around and claiming they're lower in the A1C. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll pay the line dancing in a Broadway show. And it's like, no, this is not. But I still believed in what doctors did.
And 3/4 of the commercial is side effects.
Yeah. It's like I had to look up things and realize that, you know, a certain thing was like the area between, you know, like between your butt and your front genitals. And like, why is this thing that is for, eczema swelling that part of a person's body up? Like,
right.
And causing a lump in their neck. Like, none of this makes any sense, but I believe that doctors were doing their best. And now I don't have a hatred of the individual that's a doctor. I realize they're in a system where they are controlled and they are not able to do what is best in their own opinion. They have to follow protocol.
Yeah.
And they have very little leeway. And even where they have leeway, then you can just take it away because, like some of the medications that they did for COVID that were alternate, they were off-label. But they had prescribed shit off-label all day long, every day, and it was fine. Until we got to this one magical place where that all went out the window. So that just broke faith for me.
Yeah.
Same.
Yeah, it's the capture of our institutions, and this is across the board. Any medical system, any political system, they've really been captured by the regulatory industry. And they can set who's the bad guy and who the good guy is. And even this falls in line, I think, with the way that the companies are ran as well, because, you know, we have this huge pharmaceutical system that has all these lobbyists. It's all connected to the food system as well. And they're all in each other's pockets. So you're right. There's a flip of a switch. They can change what is good, what is bad, what is accepted. Hey, this drug over here that is been on the market and is generic for 50, 60 years. We're not going to test that for this, but we're going to go test this patented, copyrighted drug that is owned by a pharmaceutical company first, because we can make a lot more money off of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of gross to watch it happen, but like I said, it's all breaking out now. Yeah. And we have solutions.
I think it's a good thing in a way, a weird backlash wave, that there are so many people now that I can have these kind of conversations with that I know in my, you know, my personal orbit in real life that I could not have these conversations with 6 years ago. They wouldn't listen to anything. And a few of them, I think, went deeper in the hole because they have to defend what they defended during that time for. But most people are like, yeah, now I know. And so I there's a positive feedback loop because of how draconian it was, that people that never would have woke up were like, yeah, no, I'm not doing this no more. I don't trust this anymore. And I think that's the exact opposite of what was planned.
Right.
I think the plan was we'll have total control at the end. And they went too far too fast, I think, which is, again, I think maybe good in a way. I also know, though, Sean, that you have a real background in Korean natural farming and JDAM and other, like, permaculture regen ag methodologies. I know that there was this also big change in y'all's life through the COVID years. How did things like Korean natural farming help you navigate the chaos during COVID?
So I felt like Korean natural farming came at the perfect time for the situation, because when you learn about KNF, people call it KNF, when you see it online, the acronym, created by Hung Kyu Cho, who actually just recently passed this last year, rest his soul. And he brought this wonderful method of growing to the world. He went around all of Asia and he studied all of these old techniques and he sort of combined them into his own personal technique. And it was a way to farm on your property without having to leave it, without having to really buy anything. Everything that you get is either free or so extremely cheap that it creates a foundational farming system. And this helped to crack that illusion of, I need someone else to do something for me. Like, this taught me that if I was out in the woods, stranded with nothing, I could farm with the things around me. And it helps build that confidence. It helped build that thing where we can do this on our own. We don't need a medical system, or we don't need an integrated food system that's nationwide. That it gives you that sense of stability, that sense of, like, comfort and peace, that I can make something from virtually nothing. And that's what Korean natural farming and JDAM has taught me. And it's sort of branched out into so many other aspects of my life now. And it was really a perfect timing when COVID came along. I was actually just getting into Korean natural farming, like, COVID had hit. And then my first KNF class was like 6 months later. So it was all like the universe talking to me again. and brought me out of a really low time, because, like I said, I'd lost a bunch of friends and family, and everyone around me was changing who their relationships were. And then when I went to this class, it was like, ah, here we go. Here's the community that is awake and aware of what's happening. I was the first person to speak up at the class, like, hey, you know, these masks don't really work, right? And 5 minutes later, everyone in the class was like, thank God somebody said it. Yeah. And they're like, you all the masks out. So,
that would have gotten us banned 4 years ago, even though it says right on the box that they come in that they don't do that.
Yeah.
It was like the most obscene thing I've ever seen in my life. It was just, there was no semblance of reality left in the world. And there were people that would, no matter what they were told, as long as the box said it, they would believe it. And then there was everybody else who was like, pretty much at this point, whatever the box says, we don't believe. But what I really like the most about what you said there is the idea of being able to run your entire food production system from your property without leaving your property. That's a huge thing, because even if you can, you know, then even if you're cut off from Amazon orders, you still have self-sufficiency. Can you kind of expand on what that means?
So this system does take a little bit of time to build. You're not going to do it in the first year. You know, you're thinking long term. You're having to rebuild the health of the soil, because all of our soils have just been decimated, like really beat up with chemicals and construction and logging. And we have lost a lot of the diversity, the microbial diversity that lives in our soil. So one of the main aspects to Korean natural farming is you farm or you collect what's called indigenous microorganisms. And these are the microorganisms that have lived in your climate, in your zone forever. So you're trying to find the closest forest, oldest forest to your area, and you're going to go there and you're going to collect fungal collections. You're going to do this, you're going to boil some rice and you're going to put in a box and you're going to allow fungal strands to grow into the rice. Then you're going to stabilize that and you're going to inoculate your soil then with this fungal inoculant, which should be very diverse. You want to have many different species of microorganisms, and then we're going to take that health from the forest, where we don't till, we don't add fertilizer, we don't water it. It just takes care of itself. Like there's no one out there managing the health of the forest unless you're doing some clear cutting, you know, for fires. Otherwise, the forest provides all the nutrition that it needs. It sequesters all of the water that it needs. It sequesters all of the organic matter that it needs to sustain itself. So the idea is to try to take the health and the sustainability of a forest and bring it into your land. And like I said, indigenous microorganisms is one way, and there are several other methods involved, like cover cropping and some nutrient extracts you can make from different rocks and vinegars. There's a bunch of little recipes that are really cool and make it really fun.
Yeah, definitely. You guys have a business, right? You want to tell us a little bit about that business, and then anybody with a business, I'm kind of asking this right now, are you being impacted in any way by the tariffs? Because supposedly they're destroying the entire world right now as we speak. We just don't see it. Your house is literally on fire because of tariffs and the army. And I have a feeling it probably didn't affect you very much.
No, not at all, actually. Well, except one thing. Like I said, I specifically built the company so that we wouldn't have to worry about international shipping. I don't have to worry about, mandates and lockdowns. And there's only one thing, though, that we have not been able to get in America. And it's one of the reasons why I think we need the tariffs. The tariffs are very important because we need to bring manufacturing back to their country, because I cannot find a glass bottle in America. I want to use glass for my product. I don't want to use plastic. But you cannot find a glass manufacturer in America. I looked. I called several companies, and every single one of them told me everything is made overseas. You cannot find glass in America. And it blew me away. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I am willing to pay a little more for an American-made bottle than get it from overseas. So the bottle doesn't necessarily affect my price. I'm just going to eat it.
You know, that's crazy to me. Of course, they'll say, Americans don't want that job. There's plenty of Americans that want jobs. I mean, really. Like, yeah, I guarantee you the guy that's scrubbing toilets every day would prefer to make bottles.
Right.
It's also like the first thing I think of with that is, so what happens to all this recycled glass that all of us, you know, that do recycling are putting our glass bottles in to be recycled? You would think they recycle glass into glass. And it makes me think of the memes you see where, like, they have the thing in the building and it says garbage and recyclables, and then you look at it and it goes in the same hole.
The same bin, yeah.
It's just like fake. There's nothing real about it. I guess the other thing is, I know someone else who's told me the same thing in our community. He does a whole line of like sauces and marinades and stuff like that. Same thing. He wants to sell. He does meads under the table type thing, and he wants to sell in glass only. And he does. Yeah. And it's the one thing he cannot source domestically. So it's definitely a thing. It's kind of crazy, really. And of all the things to ship that have the least amount of utility in shipping that distance over that time with that weight and being that fragile, glass just seems like,
right?
Why would you want to put glass in a container on a ship from China? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm betting you can get glass made in Mexico probably, but still, right. Like, we should have somebody making glass containers in America.
Right.
Right. And then if we get, let's say we get a box that has a broken glass in it, I'm supposed to throw that whole box out. I have to return the whole box because we do medicinal mushroom extracts that you're consuming. Sure. You know, so you can't be consuming little micro shards of glass. If one of those things breaks, you know, basically the entire box is contaminated. So, drop a crate too hard, you know, bump it into something. I can imagine it happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. We do have somebody saying they know a place you can get them.
USA bottles?
No.
Are they manufactured here in America?
Packaging, I don't know. Maybe not. You guys can check later for yourself. This is the company that Tigro says that they use them from them. So maybe they're worth checking into.
Okay.
Maybe it's like you say. It could be they're an American company and they ship from their place. He said, yes, they are. And they sell both manufactured and imported. So maybe you guys found a supplier. That would be great. Like, I love the power of community that we create here.
Huh. Awesome. Well, great. We'll look into them.
Yeah.
Sure.
That'd be good to know. I'm going to let John know too, if that's the case, because it would solve a problem for him as well. Let's talk a little bit more about the healthcare industry, or as I call it, the sick care industry. We spend about $4 trillion in this country on health care, which, again, I think it's a terrible term, but it's what it's classified of as. And I've been saying for years, like, health insurance isn't the problem, the cost of care is. Like, you want, and what people expect from health insurance is ridiculous, by the way. They want, basically, it would be like buying car insurance that covered filling up your gas tank and your oil changes. And you want it to cost $150. Like, and nobody actually expects that, but they want health insurance that covers every single thing in their life forever, you know, for free, let alone $150. But how did we become, or how do we get to the point where, like literally one of the largest segments of the United States economy is the healthcare industry? And I think everybody looks at it and goes, well, that makes sense. Everybody needs healthcare. And no, it doesn't make sense because it didn't used to be.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It has become, I think, one of the largest economies in America right now is actually our supposed healthcare industry. And that really blows me away. It's, why is that the number one profit-driven industry in America right now? That should tell you that something is way off. I'm sure Jen has several stories she can give on that.
Well, I feel like the reason it's so successful in what they're trying to do is it's all fear-based. And if you can scare somebody into believing that their mother's going to pass away or their baby's going to be harmed if they don't take this or that, that's all you really have to do. And everything in the health industry feeds into the other, where even the insurance. So it's the insurance, it's the formula, it's everything feeds into each other, and it's the biggest revenue that anybody, I mean, you're not going to make more money on anything else because it's like that. Like I said, it's that fear, and I've seen it 100 times. You're like trying to convince somebody, oh, this is what you need. And you know, in your head, they probably could just do something natural. They could probably just go outside and, like, do something natural. Just something as simple as putting your feet on the ground and being grounded. But you know you have to sell this, you know. And that's what they teach you is fear tactics. That's exactly, I would go to training every single week for about 4 hours a week. And all it is people learning how to manipulate and use fear tactics to get you to purchase what you want them to purchase. And so I think that's why it's the biggest money maker. And it's easy to do because people are easy to manipulate, as we saw during COVID. So.
And it's all connected to the medical industry is actually in lock with the food industry as well.
Yeah.
As we know, things like Philip Morris, you know, the original tobacco companies, when tobacco started to take a hit, they changed to the food industry. Mm-hmm. You know, Philip Morris owns Kraft, you know, and they took all of these addictive style formulas and put it into the food. And now the food is making you sick, which means that you need to go on a quote unquote statins or metformin. And once they get you on those, you know, there's this whole host of side effects that comes with it. And, you know, then you're locked in, you know, then you're in their system and now they have a patient for life. You know, you're
right. Well, a lot of medications, I know what we told people, and a lot of medications, we tell people it's indefinite. Like, once you start this, you're going to be on it until the day that you die. And, or there will be other medical complications. And when you really look at it and you weigh out, like, the bad things of if I did come off this medication or if I stay on it, the side effects of you staying on that medication are always typically going to outweigh what would happen to you if you came off. It's all about, you know, again, that fear and controlling people. It's really a trip.
Well, and the perceived authority of the doctor in the white coat, right? Like, the doctor said you have to do it. And I find as people get older, if they don't have a wake-up point in their life, that becomes more true. Like, my father-in-law, anything the doctor said, it might as well be the president of the United States came to your house and told you to do it. And you're the kind of person that would listen to the president of the United States. Like,
right. It's
like that much authority because the guy was a doctor. It didn't matter what doctor, right? Like, not just the doctor he trusted, but any doctor that he would encounter that would tell him, you need to do this. Well, I mean, the doctor said so, right? And, like, that kind of obedience leads to the type of problem we're talking about. But, like, hey, Alabama right here is saying insurance is why healthcare is so expensive. Docs are happy to have the big pool of money to swim in. But the reality is, like, insurance is why medical care got expensive, but as medical care got expensive, that's why insurance got more. And they just kind of ping pong back and forth. As you increase the cost of care, you increase the cost of insurance, which increases the money pool, which increases, like, it's just nonstop stair step. And a lot of these companies are pulling money off both sides of that.
Mm-hmm.
They absolutely are. And then, you know, then we'll pass a law that says you get fined if you don't have insurance, even though you can't afford it. But we'll call it the Affordable Care Act, which will be affordable for most people to have. The whole thing is a scam.
Yeah.
It really is. It's a complete scam. Right. It is the biggest ripoff I've ever seen. And I don't know that you could expect it to work any other way. If you create, like, here's what just happened in my own family that shows how true it is that doctors are parasitic to the insurance company. My grandson got blasted in the face with a baseball during a game. I mean, probably 70 mile an hour ball. It was just thrown by a fielder going to the wrong cutoff man. So he wasn't even really guarding himself because he's pretty damn good. It probably wouldn't have happened otherwise. They take him to the hospital because he just won't stop bleeding. And it's pretty damn bad. I mean, full on straight shot in the face.
Ouch.
And the doctors say, oh, he needs a CAT scan. And my son says, you know, we're paying cash. We don't have insurance for him. Oh, he doesn't need a CAT scan. You can get an X-ray maybe tomorrow at a walk-in clinic. It'll cost you less. The second they knew they didn't, and that is not the first time I've seen that. I remember my son, when he was in high school, rolled an ankle playing basketball. My wife took him into the ER. They looked at it, said, yeah, he needs a CAT scan. We don't have insurance. Oh. We even did. Just said it to see what they would say. it'll probably be fine.
Yeah, it'll be okay. Oh, man. It'll be okay, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So many times. I'm also thinking, here's your bill for $8,000. Yeah, we don't have $8,000. Well, here's your payment plan. Yeah, we're not doing that. I will give you $2,500 and we'll call it done. But we're not doing that. Okay. And then 2 days later, somebody from bill collection goes, I understand that you're willing to settle this for $2,500. Yeah, now it's $2,100. And they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
No, they're just grifting.
Yeah.
And then you have insurance companies that are, and the insurance company's paying a third or less of what you would pay anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the whole thing is just this money grab ass pile of crap.
Yeah.
And that's why we need people pointing out, like, opt out of the system unless you need it. If I get a wreck and there's a yield sign in my spleen, I want you to take me to a surgeon. Okay. Yes, I need that. If I have aches, pains, whatever, I'm dealing with a chronic condition, almost inevitably I'm going to do better outside the system.
Yes. And what most people don't even realize is that when you go to a doctor, if you tell them whether you have insurance or not, if you just tell them, I don't have insurance, they're going to give you a totally set of different prices, like a total like printout of, well, this is what your cash cost is, because they can't charge. I mean, they could not treat people with, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's impossible. They know that they can get a lot more out of you if you have insurance, but there is a totally different set of pricing for people that don't. And that's with most doctor's office, even hospitals, like you just outright tell them, I don't have it. They'll give you different pricing.
And Jim has some interesting solutions with that. You learned about doctors and pharmacists from your job.
Yeah.
And how you can cut some costs with a pharmacist.
Well, and I feel like what people don't realize, people look at doctors, like we were saying, and they think, well, that what they say is the end all say all, and that is not the case at all. In fact, doctors only take, I think, 1 to 2 classes on drugs, like pharmacy drugs that they're going to be prescribing to people. They do not understand what they're giving you, and especially if you have a doctor writing you a prescription for a compounded pharmacy, you better make sure that you have a good pharmacist, because I can't tell you how many times we would catch these mistakes that could kill people coming from doctors. And what I have always told people is, like, you can just skip out on the doctor unless, like you said, you have a sign in your spleen. If you break something, of course, go to the doctor. But if you're just looking for, like, something to help you get through a cold, something to help you get through having the flu, and you're not a high-risk person, go talk to your pharmacist. They're happy to talk to you for free, and they oftentimes will tell you exactly what you need to take, and they'll even tell you natural things that you could take to help you get through things. And I had a pharmacist save my life. I had the doctors completely – I was in the hospital for 5 days. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. They had me on IV, everything.
Yeah.
And they dismissed me because they were like, we are not sure what's wrong with you, and if we keep you, you're a liability. So we're just going to dismiss you? Yeah. And what I did is I went to work with my lab work, and I went up to our team of pharmacists, and I was like, does anybody know anything about – and I started listing things on my paperwork. Yeah. And this guy raises his hand, and he's like, come sit with me. I sat with him for an hour, and – the whole thing could have been avoided. He told me, he's like, oh, well, you have a biofilm in your lymph nodes. Just take xylitol with your antibiotic, and it'll be gone. I was like, what? That's it? And he's like, I already ordered you the xylitol. It's downstairs with your name on it. Just take a spoon. Yeah, just take a spoon of it with your antibiotic. And in 2 weeks, something that had been affecting me for over 3 weeks, mm-hmm. and they had already tried to cut my breast off, like do invasive surgery, it was gone.
Yeah.
And it was basically that the antibiotic wasn't getting to where it wasn't passing a membrane.
That's right.
So mm-hmm. let's do something to get it through the membrane and remove the membrane, a lot like using, I don't know, an ionophore for zinc, but we won't go into that because I got for that when I talked about it in the past, right? Like, a lot of these solutions, when they do need medication, are actually very simple. But simple doesn't pay big bills. We got to have the ability to make lots and lots of money all the time, and God forbid we don't, you know, make more money. And it's a money hamster wheel is what they've turned it into, and it makes sense. Like, and you see the same pattern everywhere. Like, go get your car serviced. They always have like 4 more things it needs that are urgent that are not, right? And that's just because the service writer's told, just add shit, because they might say yes. And now they don't even talk to you anymore. You get like a link on your phone and it says, do you approve this? It's like, no, 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 right? Like, I'm not going to pay you $85 to replace an air filter, because that's going to give you a bump in your riff on writing my service up. No, I'm not going to do that. And so that sounds completely unrelated, but it's not. It's just the natural outcome of a business model where you are incentivized to make more money by doing more things. Right. We used to do it in the cable business. I'll be honest about it. Back when I used to run cabling crews, like for the school system, and all, you call us in on warranty work and we teach the tech. While you're there, see if there's anything else you can do that we can bill for.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we would have never done the thing, but if we can get away with billing for it, now we covered the cost of the warranty work. Like, that's just how business is going to work. And if you create a system that's designed to grift, then the grift will be extreme. At least in those instances, the customer can say no. But in a lot of this stuff in the medical industry, maybe you can say no, but people think they can't. Like, I love when you say, like, well, you can't leave.
Right. No, you can.
And am I here on some sort of mental illness hold or something? Like a, you know, whatever, like a code 5 or some shit? No? Okay. Well, bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But they'll tell people you can't leave. We're not going to release you yet.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know you were police officers, but people just do it. And then they'll say, we need to run these 5 more tests before we're going to release you. Yeah. Well, that's just billing. That's all that is.
Yeah.
You see people go into an ER for 3 hours and get a bill for $1,200. They literally didn't do anything.
Right. And your ibuprofen was like $800.
Yes.
Right.
So I've got ibuprofen. I'll give them the ibuprofen. No, you can't do that. Watch. See? It just happened. What are you going to do?
Right.
You're not going to do anything about it.
But ask forgiveness, not for permission.
But Jen, you got off of like SSRIs, antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
Drugs, and you did this all mostly with mushrooms, diet, and environment change. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So when I met Sean, I was on an SSRI. I was on a mood stabilizer. I was on, I think my original cocktail was 3 pills, and then once I started taking those for several months, I began having side effects, and then we started putting me on medication to treat my restless leg syndrome and my stomach problems that was all side effects from the drugs. And then also, let's see, what else? Oh, just insomnia in general. Like, I wouldn't sleep for days. I was, like, hallucinating. It was rough. But even then, with all of those side effects, I was, like, clinging to my drugs. Like, because it was the only thing, and I can say this, like, if you're just starting your journey with your mental health, like, yes, those drugs are the first thing that make you feel some kind of normal. Like, I can attest to that. And it was so, I was so passionate about it up front with Sean. I was like, don't talk to me about trying to get me off my medicine. This is like a no conversation zone on this right here, you know. But what happened was my main medication, which was my miracle drug, it was a mood stabilizer, and it was the only thing that really made me feel better. It went on back order, and it didn't just go on back order here. It was on back order everywhere. Mm. And I called my psychiatrist, and I was like, what are we going to do? And she's like, I already know. I've already been thinking about you. Like, we can try you on this drug, that drug. And I was like, well, I have this boyfriend that says he can help me with mushrooms. And I couldn't believe it, and she was like, oh, my gosh, well, if you have access to that, you should absolutely do that. And I'll give it to her. Like, she's a really good doctor. And she told me, she said, at the end of this journey, you probably won't be my patient. Huh. But she's like, that's the goal, isn't it? And I was
it
like,
should be.
Yeah. And so she helped me start with Sean. She helped me start doing more medicinal mushrooms. And, yes, I am off of all of my medication. I don't think you can even diagnose me with anything anymore. And, like, of course, I have bad days. Everybody has bad days. Sure. But for people to think that you won't have bad days, that's just
right.
That's crazy.
It's just normal life
it's
suffering.
Normal. Yeah, but, and there is suffering in life. But yeah. Now that I'm off the medication, I had no idea how sedated I was, how little I was feeling. Like, it dampers everything, and it makes it where you don't feel as much. You don't love as much. Like, you can't, for me, that's what
it
is.
No, you're dead on. It's like a dimmer switch, right? So, like, these things happen to you. They don't, it's not like you're yourself. You start taking this medication, and then in 2 days, you're completely down here, where you have a contrast, you have this slow decline,
yes.
And you become convinced that's the illness itself, and what you need is more drugs, so the decline increases over time, and you don't even have a memory of where you were versus where you are, and then when you come off it and you come back to normal, or even close to the baseline of normal, you're like, oh shit, that's how bad it was.
Yes, and you have no idea. No idea. But I'm telling you, I had no idea, like zero idea that was happening to me. You couldn't have paid me to believe it until I got out of it. And It was some of the craziest withdrawal symptoms I had coming off of SSRIs. Yeah. Like, it makes you sick. It makes you feel like your life is going to end, like, today. Like, it was terrible.
Yeah, but they're withdrawals, but the doctor will tell you that you're still depressed or you're still having mental health issues when it's the withdrawals from the SSRIs because, you know, just on this journey, we had to just start researching the drugs ourselves. And come to find out, SSRIs are extremely effective at very tiny doses. Mm-hmm. So when you're coming off of it, you have to come off very, very slowly. Like at first, it's 10% at a time until you get down to 10%. And when you're at that last 10%, it's like 1% or less reduction. You have to use a microgram scale to find the correct dosage so that you don't have massive withdrawal effects when you're coming off.
And of course, I'm hard-headed and I want to do everything my own way. And so I'm like, I'm just going to stop, right? I'm just going to, and I did. And it was very hard, but yeah. I made it, right? I'm sitting here and I made it. And so it's like, and I did talk with my doctor about it and she even said, you have to push through it because this is going to be the hardest part. Like back 7 years ago, when you came to me and you thought your life was over, that was not the hardest part. Like, this will be the hardest part. And she wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
But I did it. And now I'm able to function and, like, be a better daughter and be a better sister and be a good wife. Like, I was just going through the motions like a zombie before. And it, you don't know it until you know, you know?
And so. It shows you how predatory the system is, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they don't know everything you just said.
Right.
When they're dishing these things out like freaking M&Ms, and they'll put kids on that shit.
Oh, yeah.
And next thing you know, the kid's shooting up a school and it's a gun's fault.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, no, right? I'm thinking, no, you're literally at the point where the brain is not fully developed, interfering with the chemical processes that allow for things like empathy to actually happen.
Right.
And if you have somebody in a bad situation already, then, like, you know, shooting up a school might in their brain become a solution to their problem, especially if they decide, because it causes suicidal thoughts as well, you know, I'm going to take myself out, but I might as well take some people with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's the 1% that end up in that space of even considering it. Then you got the other 99%. It just destroys you. And then you end up like, I have to take it because it makes me feel better. And they don't realize, no, you have to take it because it makes you not feel bad when you don't take it. Like, those are different things. Like, I had a friend that had an addiction to heroin. He didn't like it when he quit doing it. But
right.
The solution wasn't more heroin.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But imagine if you could sell something like heroin completely legally. And you could build a business with, you know, 30 million people taking your product. Well, if you were greedy, you just might do that. Right? That just might seem like a really great business model. Like, I could just see people in a business suit sitting around a $80,000 commerce table going, we can do this legally? Yeah, we bought the stuff off at the FDA.
That's exactly what's happening with sugar right now.
Yeah.
And
sure.
Carbohydrates. You know, this was a part of the process was getting all of the bad food out of our system. Because if we didn't stop eating the sugar, if we didn't stop eating all of the GMO grains, we're now on like a paleo keto type diet where we removed all the carbohydrates. That was a huge, huge help for Jen. You know, maintaining those levels of stability because it helps with the microbiome. You know, these carbohydrates and the sugar just totally decimates our gut biome. And the gut biome is intimately connected to the brain. There's a vagus nerve that runs from your large intestine, small intestine, gallbladder, spleen, heart, and then it goes in the back of your head. And whatever you have going on in your intestines is going to be manifested in your thoughts. It's going to be manifested in your focus and your memory, and it even leads to mental health conditions. So the diet itself is leading to the mental health problem as well. And it's like a vicious loop. And then the mental health problem leads to upset microbiomes as well. So changing the diet, getting different mushrooms into a Jen system, like lion's mane was a huge one. It's great for growing out the beneficial bacteria. as well as having what we know as our nootropic capabilities. So it's going to repair neurons. It's going to help fix the synapses in the brain, as well as a prebiotic to grow up the microbiome in our guts. And then once you start taking care of the gut, is this intimate relationship with the brain, and so many things just start clicking into place. Yeah, it's been nice. Things like turkey tail, oyster, cordyceps, all of these are really great for your microbiome and great for the brain as well. So.
And I can say that I've never had an SSRI work as well as when I balanced my gut biome, because I used to think I was broken and SSRIs didn't work on me. Because, you know, you hear all these stories, people are like, oh, yeah, I started taking my meds and I feel great. I experienced that for about 3 months, and then we would go right back to all the depression. And once we started working on getting my gut biome straight, it's insane. It like makes the SSRIs look like crap, because they are. Yeah. But it's really crazy. And I tell people every weekend, because we work markets for our company, and I tell people every weekend that suffer with depression or suffer with anxiety, I'm like, I know it's hard, and I'm not saying this is all you need to do, because only you know what you need to do for you. But if you could like get your gut biome straight, like you would be ahead of the game. Yeah. Is all I'm saying. Yeah.
With the people saying it works, though, it makes me think of way back when I was a teenager. I had a great uncle, and it was about the time that they called them Mickey Mouse boots from the Korean War era hit the market, and all these hunters were buying these Mickey Mouse boots. But they called them that because they actually had a thing where you could inflate them with air, and they were supposed to insulate your feet.
Yeah.
And I was telling my great uncle, who was a Korean War vet, I was thinking about picking some up because they weren't that expensive, because they don't work. They don't work for the shit. Trust me, I wore them in Korea, and they didn't keep my feet warm for nothing. Like, the only time my feet weren't cold in the winter is when I was being shot at, so I didn't know it. And I'm like, well, then why do all these people say that bought them that they work? And they said, well, if you go out and buy those goofy-looking things, put them on your feet, walk around, you're not going to admit to anybody that don't work. Right?
It's really,
and I think it's kind of the same thing, like pattern recognition. Another thing you said with the pattern recognition, and I'm glad you brought it up, is the carbohydrates and the sugar.
Mm-hmm.
But weekly, I have a discussion with somebody online about how carbohydrates and sugar are the same thing. And they go through this long bullshit about why they're not. You know, sugar is sugar and carb. No, they're the same thing. And one thing that no one can ever give me an answer for is if I say, well, then how about this? How about you give me 5,000 grams of carbohydrate in the form of bread? You give me 5,000 grams of carbohydrate in the form of potatoes. You give me 5,000 grams of carbohydrate in the form of sugar. And you give me 5,000 grams of carbohydrate in your choice of any other form. And I will take all of them and put them in four different fermenters, and then I will run them through my still, and we will get the exact same amount of ethyl alcohol from all four sources. If it's not the same as sugar, how does that happen?
Right.
Because there's only one thing that makes ethyl alcohol when combined with yeast, and that is sugar.
Sugar, yep.
Mm-hmm.
So if the same grams of each one make the same amount of alcohol and your body breaks those carbohydrates down inside your bloodstream, then how is it different? And then they get mad and run away.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
You just don't know. You can listen to a nutritionist, right? You know? Carbohydrates is your brain food. Only eat half a potato. So you, if you've seen that video. It's ridiculous. It's
like, maybe if you were in Italy,
right.
Maybe if you were in a country where they don't spray glyphosate all over their crops and they don't hit it with ammonium nitrates and then hit it with pesticides and then hit it with an herbicide.
Then
that carbohydrate's, you know, better for you. But, you know, everything we get here in America is just been devoid of nutrition because of the damage that we've done to our soils. Then they have to throw pesticides on it because now the bugs are eating it because of the chemical fertilizer. And then right before they harvest, they're going to spray it with Roundup to kill it all so that they can harvest it easier.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't think none of that's going into our bodies and combining with that sugar to really just completely wipe out America's health. That's why we have all the chronic issues that we have now. It's part of the $4 trillion medical institution,
mm-hmm.
And pharmaceutical institution is our food systems.
It's also like there is something to the way the food is treated. I completely believe that. There's also dietary habits that I think people think that in Italy they just eat these giant bowls of pasta that are like this big or something, and bread and everything. And, you know, you go to Italy and you go to a real Italian restaurant in Italy that's not for tourists, that's for Italians, and they bring a loaf of bread out at the very beginning like they do in America, and no one touches it. Then they bring a small portion of pasta, lightly sauced with some sort of protein on it out, and what everybody does is eats the pasta first and then dumps olive oil in the bowl and uses one piece of bread to mop up the sauce out of the bowl. So they just, that same meal, in theory, just became a much lower carbohydrate meal and, like you said, a healthier source of the carbohydrates. So, yeah, right. Because you've got the carbohydrates, one being sugar, but two, then you've got you can't ignore the glyphosate and the atrazine and all the other crap that's in there, and then all of the additives and preservatives that are in there. Like, you buy pasta from Italy, it's like, you know, wheat.
Right. Oh, it's heavy.
It's very heavy.
Yeah, and it's like you can only eat a small portion of it before you're like almost totally full. It's kind of crazy. We've been getting some pasta from a lady who gets her flour from Italy, and it's a completely different experience. You just can't even compare the two.
And I don't even remember the exact number, but I remember a Bill Mollison lecture where he was talking about how even in the 1920s, you had to test wheat for a certain protein amount. And if it was below that, it was not considered suitable for humans to eat.
Oh, interesting.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So you couldn't even sell it as human food, and it was higher than anything you can buy today.
Mm-hmm.
And it was routine. And the other thing he said is it was before all the mechanization with harvest, and they would do the sheaves of wheat in the field that looked so pastoral and beautiful. He said they didn't do that because it looked nice. They did it because they had to put it up like that so it would completely dry out because you couldn't spray it with glyphosate to kill it and dry it out faster and harvest with a combine. And when it was all stacked together like that, it would actually do a natural form of fermentation.
Oh, you're right. Interesting.
So when you take away the testing for the protein and the fermentation, you're not even eating the same product.
Right.
So when they say, well, my granddaddy and my great-granddaddy lived on this and they lived to be 90, they didn't live on what you're eating.
No.
Yeah, not the same thing.
You call it wheat, but it's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And the fermentation is really interesting to me because that brings in a whole litany of microorganisms, which must be indigenous because they weren't spraying it with some weird formation. There was IMO, like as you talk about it in KNF, is very specific, but the reality is IMO is everywhere. That's the point.
Everywhere, yeah.
I mean, I look at my composting methodology as pretty much it's a giant IMO collection system. It's what it really is.
Yeah.
It takes a year to make. It's a rough surface top. You know, it's done on the ground. It's always in contact with the ground. Like, and I didn't even, when I was designing it and adapting Dr. Johnson's methods for it, I didn't even realize that what I was doing, but I was working with Matt Powers on some things at the same time with indigenous microorganisms. And I'm like, well, shit, basically everything that works, it doesn't require continuous therapy, is some form of IMO, whether we're eating it, using it, it doesn't matter. That's the only thing we really have that's sustainable.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's everywhere around us. Yeah, and I love Matt. Matt's a good friend of mine, actually. And he is doing some fantastic work, groundbreaking stuff. And he's really taken some of these aspects from Korean natural farming, and we're putting them under a microscope and figuring out some really cool sustainable recipes. And yes, your pile that lasts 12 months, I guess that's the Johnson Sue method. Yeah, fantastic IMO. Probably one of the most concentrated beneficials of the composting systems is Johnson Sue.
And I'm also using wood chips that are 5 years old on average. Like, you know, like that's what Matt came here and he looked at it and goes, I get it now. You're patient. I'm like, I'm glad you think patient and lazy are the same.
Right? It's a great, great patient system. Yeah.
Yeah. Just be lazy and let nature do the work. Right.
Yeah, that's what we're doing here, actually, with the mushroom spawn. We haven't got the system in place yet, but we're building our Johnson Sue reactors, and everything that's left over from the mushrooms is going to go in there, and then we won't have any waste. Everything will be a product. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm playing with a lot of it myself. In fact, right now I've got just developing a little bit of pink oyster mushroom on some grinds and little, just really simple, a little bit of the first aid micropore tape for a little bit of breath, and we'll see how that one comes out. And I've got blue oysters pinning on a rack right behind here. So, yeah, it's
lovely.
And now with the Johnson Sue, what I'm doing is I'm introducing sawdust spawn well after the thermophilic cycle is, but where there's about 6 months left in the reactor. And I'm trying, I've got two trials running right now. I'm doing a Phoenix Oyster because it likes our high temperature. And the other one really likes high temperatures is called Patty Straw. So I'm doing one each in each reactor to see what type of differential I get from it.
Right. Okay. So that, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. One thing I would be concerned about is if you're adding oyster to a composting system, yeah. It's going to kill all the nematodes, both good and bad. Okay. So just FYI, but down the road, the longer you let it go, it ends up making a more diverse system.
Yeah.
In the end, it's just, if you do add like a fresh thing of oyster, it's going to kill all the nematodes, just letting you know.
Interesting. That actually has some applications though. Let's kind of shift into that. How can we use mushrooms to fix our topsoil loss and repair the microbiome?
Yeah, so the soil and your gut health are pretty much the same. Like, what's going on in the soil should be what's actually going on in your gut in a healthy system. there, these intimate relationships between the compounds that we find in the soil. There's a doctor named Dr. Zach Bush. He does a lot of cancer research, and he was actually starting to find these compounds that he was researching to kill cancer in soil samples. It's like, what is going on? I'm supposed to be researching these compounds to kill cancer in a petri dish and in lab rats and stuff, but I'm finding these compounds in healthy soil. So this aspect of like all is one really comes into play here, and that's where I think the IMO, the Johnson Sioux, if we start creating your arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, where you put a living plant root into your compost, let that plant like get nice and thriving and healthy, and then take that and cut it down, and now you have your symbiotic fungus that can form the relationships with trees and different plants. So getting the most amount of diversity into the soil, and then taking that food that you grew in your healthy soil and getting that into your body is where it all comes from. And the more of the processed food that we eat, the things that don't come from the soil, or they went through a factory and they got processed into some little package instead of going straight into your pan or straight into your oven and then straight into your body, we need to skip the processing stage and to take raw foods that we get from our local environments, which is what we're trying to do here in Texas. I'm trying to get a bunch of farms together that are growing food locally so that we can create our own local community, indigenous microorganism, healthy food, because those microbes are going to live on the cucumber. It's going to live on the surface of the tomato that are out here. And then you get those into your bodies. And if those microorganisms aren't local, then they're not going to be as beneficial to your body in the end. So taking care of our soil is extremely important. We need to get back to smaller farms. I think Korean Natural Farming, Jadam, Johnson Sioux is actually going to make it feasible for us instead of having to spend all this money on chemicals and fertilizers and all of these problems. You can do it very cheaply using these methods. It's a little bit of work. I said at first, it takes a couple of years to really get the system like up and running, but the results have been amazing. Like Gabe Brown uses types of regenerative systems, and he has like, I think 5,000 acres of grain. And I mean, he's killing it. He has better yields. He has higher quality than the conventional systems that are around him. You know, the evidence is there. It's just a matter of, that year or two of getting yourself set up.
Yeah, it does take some time. That's one of the biggest pushbacks I've had with the Johnson Sioux method, is it takes a year. So you don't have to do anything except make sure it stays damp and protected. That's all you have to do. And you can make some fast turn compost for your first season. But the reason I'm playing with the mushrooms is I'm trying to give people a way to make that year also productive. And by timing the start, what I'm actually doing is I'm cultivating mushrooms in the bioreactors, but I'm also cultivating vegetables in the bioreactors. If you're about 5 months in, it'll work. It's just you really don't want to mess with it yet. But all adding things that grow in it do, as far as like vegetables, like I'll grow watermelon or squash or something. All you're doing is creating endophytic reactions.
Yes.
and you're actually, by having living root in the system, you're also now, you know, cultivating things like mycorrhizal fungi, where people think they're doing that in their compost. No, you're not. It needs a living root to interact with to actually right. cultivate it. So mm-hmm. by doing that, you're increasing that. I didn't realize I was killing nematodes. But, you know, like you said, that's
okay.
That's why I do two different things at the same time, so I can analyze the results and see what we get out of it. And I also wonder, am I killing nematodes in a bioreactor that's, you know, 3 foot tall? Am I killing the nematodes that are 3 foot deep down in the reactor? Probably.
If the mycorrhizae grows all the way down to the bottom, then anything that it touches. But like I said, in the long run, it actually creates a more diverse system. Mm-hmm. So if you put the oyster in there, yes, it's going to kill all the nematodes. But 12 months from now, you'll have a healthier compost than if you didn't add it originally.
I got 12 months anyway. So
right.
And what we've noticed is that making compost like that really lets you scale if you want to. Like, I have a relatively small property, but, you know, people that are doing 40 acres, 400 acres, 4,000 acres, like, they can't do it. But we'll take the amount of, you know, compost that fits in this little glass right here, and we'll make a spray out of that. Mm-hmm. And you spray a garden with it, and the next day it looks like you had a thunderstorm the night before, where everything just kind of greens up after a thunderstorm. Yep. And that's where you realize it is the biology, because there's no way there's enough, you know, nutrient as far as NPK and your micro and your macros. There's no way there's enough of that in there to do that, to get that result. But you get that result every time you do it.
Right.
So
yeah.
It has to be the biology, because absolutely. That's the only explanation you have.
Yeah. They, you know, plants are carnivores, actually. Mm-hmm. they literally will attract and consume bacteria. They're looking for him. That's actually one of their main functions, is to, like Hansel and Gretel, it's like attracting bacteria to it. And then as soon as they get close enough, it grabs onto it and it actually pulls it into its body and absorbs it. And that's where it gets the majority of its nitrogen from. It's really cool. And that's why you get that burst every time you spray and you get those bacteria in there. It's getting like 40 to 50% of the nitrogen that it needs just from the bacteria alone. Yeah, it's really cool stuff.
Well, it does make sense that, you know, 78% of the atmosphere is nitrogen. We really shouldn't have to go out and find a whole lot of extra nitrogen when every time you breathe, you're cycling nitrogen through your lungs, and so is the plant. I've actually picked up on that's part of why we get that. You get a really intense thunderstorm, and you go out in the morning, and the grass almost looks like something on a Star Trek film, like it's weird green. It's because that plasma drives more nitrogen into the water from the lightning strikes. So pure nitrogen in the water coming into the plant, and that's what's causing it. So there's actually research being done now where they're developing little low-scale plasma generators and running water through it when they're drip irrigating small-scale farms. And they're providing nitrogen to the plants from the atmosphere.
Okay.
Kind of awesome. Like you do, like it looks a lot like a UV purifier, where like if you have a well system, you run it through the UV lights, except it's running through plasma.
Okay, interesting. I've never heard of that.
Low, like, it doesn't take much energy to do it, and like there's so many things we haven't even scratched the surface on that we don't need chemicals. Right. And the problem is when you say that, a lot of new people really fall out because you tell them they don't need chemicals, but they don't do anything.
Right.
Right.
You need something. You have to replace.
You know, something grew. Well, yeah, because I didn't say you didn't need to do anything. I said you didn't need chemicals.
Right. Yeah.
And sometimes you might need some chemicals, right? Like, and because everything's a chemical. Water is a chemical. So when I say that, I mean, like, if you have no magnesium or you have no molybdenum on your property at all, and it's just not there, you don't have a sun in your backyard to fuse higher level elements, you don't have a fusion reactor, then you might need, you know, I think it was John Kemp talks about that, and his whole company's built on that. Sometimes there is a chemical component to it, but if you do it absent the biological, it's pointless.
Right.
A lot of the times these nutrients will bind together, and there's plenty of it there, and you test it, it says it's there, but the plant can't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you add it and it immediately binds up with something else and the plant can't get it. And you're like, I don't understand.
Yeah, then you put more.
Here. I'm sitting on limestone. I had calcium deficiency problems when I moved into my plants.
Wow.
Because all the calcium was bound up
walked up to
and
the
there's a magnesium shortage, and just like us, we need magnesium and calcium together. We can't absorb it. So do the plants. And then I learned from Matt that once they go over a certain temperature, the plant can't synthesize the calcium out of the soil during those dark periods of our summer when it's like 111 degrees out. And mm-hmm. so at that point, you do, in the evening, some supplemental calcium in a foliar. And like, but if you tested the soil, you would never know there was a problem.
Right.
And none of the extension people would ever tell you that's the problem. They don't know.
Right. Well, yeah, they ignore the biology.
Yeah.
It's been a really big missing part of horticulture, academia actually. And it's just now finally starting to kind of crack the surface. I think K&F definitely helped with that. There's some universities that have been doing studies now on microbial diversity. Christina Jones, I think Dr. Christina Jones, she has some great stuff on quorum sensing and microbial diversity. Yeah, if we don't get the microorganisms back into the soil, then the mineral just becomes that. It becomes chemistry that just locks up inside of itself. I think
quorum sensing is mind-blowing. I picked that up from Ray Archuleta. Like, you realize, like, this is one thing, and you touch it, and it cracks open, like breaking the atom open, and you're like, oh, my God. And then you realize all these things that are like that, the mainstream just washes right over because I can't package it and sell it
Mm-mm.
and make somebody dependent on me with it. And this is, again, pattern recognition. It's the pharmaceutical industry. It's the food industry. It's the petrochemical industry. It's the agrochemical industry. They're all the same pattern because the pattern works. And if you don't believe that, all you have to do, the pattern once works will be repeated. Look what happened with reality TV with the first Survivor show. They put the show out. There'd never been anything like it. They put these idiots on an island. They all fight with each other. Turned out people liked it.
Yeah.
Now there's like 8,000 versions of that show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right? And so scripted. Once the pattern is established, the pattern is repeated.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they want to.
It doesn't matter either. It doesn't matter if it's good or bad. If it works, we're going to use it.
Right.
Yeah.
they want that shelf stable product.
Yep.
I say that the healthiest aspects of our systems, of our lives, are not shelf stable.
Mm-mm.
They're temporary. You got to get them at the right time. You know, you got to eat food when it's fresh, not when it's rotted or when it's, you know, past its due date. And a lot of these things, you're right, you can't make a product out of them. They have to be done in your system at the time of their creation.
A biological organism that is static is dead.
Yes.
So it can't possibly be stable because it's alive.
Right.
Right.
And once it's dead, it's not alive anymore, so it's not good anymore. Right. I mean, this is not hard to understand.
Yeah.
I think a 7-year-old could understand that. Different words, right? Maybe put Big Bird explaining it or something, but like that's very simple. You can't have a living thing that's static.
Right.
How would you? Static would mean you hook up a thing for a heartbeat and it's not there. Well, this guy's dead. He's not breathing. He's not changing, you know, the atmosphere in his lungs into oxygen. He's not processing nutrient into caloric nutrient into body nutrient. Like, all those things mean that organism is changing constantly. So if I put it in a bag, it'll die.
Yep.
It can't be shelf stable. And I also, like with IMO, that's great. But I can't send you my IMO and really get very far with it. Like, it might work, but it's not really, even if I could keep it alive. Like, it's.
Yeah. It depends on how far away you move it.
Where do y'all live?
We're in Houston.
Okay. So it's not that. Well, it's actually very different than my climate. I'm near Fort Worth.
Right. You're drier than we are.
Way drier.
Yeah. So it would be best, actually, for me to go more towards your area and take a collection and bring it back to my area. It would actually be more beneficial because when you have a lower elevation where there's more moisture, it's easier for the microorganisms to live. So when you take a moist type collection and you bring it to a dry area, they will die off very quickly. Whereas if I take something that's from a dry area that's a little hardy, it has a little bit more resistance, it actually will survive better in my climate than if I was to do the opposite.
Yeah.
So that is part of the Korean natural farming philosophy. They talk about elevation. They talk about moisture ratings, all these little nuanced details about taking your collections. And you can stabilize IMO, but IMO is just an initial catalyst. It is not this like amazing, like crazy, diverse, instantaneous microbial collection that let's say Johnson Sioux is. Johnson Sioux is very diverse. It does create corn sensing whenever you make it correctly. Whereas IMO is like that spore catalyst. It is the initial jump start that you put into your garden to get that system going. It's what gets the engine turning to where it can start taking over for itself. Yeah, and I love IMO.
Yeah, I can tell. Probably with good reason. I've been very impressed with what I've seen by it. And I think like what I've heard from people that do this is if you don't really have an optimum collection site on your own property, try to find something in the same catchment. That was generally what I've been advised from people like Chris Trump. Like that would be ideal. But like you said, like you could bring it in from outside if that was possible, but think about it. And then you got like totally diverse situations. Like where I grew up in Pennsylvania, I wouldn't even think about trying to swap those.
That's a little too far. Yeah.
Yeah. It's completely differentiated in like a dozen ways. The climate, the elevation, the humidity, the duration of heat versus cold, like all of it is completely out of
whack. Barometric pressure, all those things change.
So if I'm, you know, Bayer Pharmaceutical combined with Monsanto Agricultural now, I can't make a product out of that I can ship all over the world. They can sit on a ship for 90 days as it crosses the ocean. I can't patent it. I can't control it. You know, so it's not good for me as a product, even if it's good for my customer to know how to use it.
Right. Yeah, it totally ruins that business model. Like Monsanto's business model would never try to pick up some kind of an IMO product unless it was like a very specific one strand that they had a patent on, you know, and then what is that really doing when you have one strand?
Yeah, definitely. Can you guys talk a little bit more about, you know, the health benefits of mushrooms that you guys have personally experienced and diet change, those two working together?
Yeah, man, mushrooms, it's been an amazing, wild journey. Originally started making it for gin, made the lion's mane and cordyceps and reishi was the first combination. That's going to help fix the neurons. It's going to help fix your gut biome at the same time. And I started giving it to her, and the amazing results from it just really opened my eyes to the rest of it. My mom got breast cancer about 4 years ago. And after her treatment, which she did very well, you know, I'll give them that. They did really well in the treatment. We started giving her turkey tail and chaga and reishi. And those are the types of mushrooms that really help focus on what's called apoptosis in the body. It is a part of the body that goes around and it does a check on each one of your cells and it says, is this a good cell or a bad cell? Mm. If you're a cancer cell, I want you to kill yourself and I want you to break yourself down and integrate yourself into the immune system so we can start recognizing this cancerous cell. It is what every one of our bodies does, and mushrooms are one of the most amazing things for activating this part of the body. The specific compound is called trehalose. It's very, there's a large amounts of it in reishi, and it's an alcohol soluble compound. So you do have to do an alcohol extraction in order to get the trehalose out of the reishi. So, and we've been giving that to her for the last 4 years. She has been in remission. I don't know if it's necessarily the mushrooms or not, but I'm going to keep giving them to her for the rest of her life. Mm-hmm. You know, Paul Stamens gave his mom turkey tail during her treatment, and she's been in remission for over 10 years now. So it seems like things are working. And because it's helped with our family so much that I had to start doing it. I started doing it a little bit more. I started taking cordyceps more just for the energy because it does give you like a natural burst of energy. And I had a friend of mine who is part of this whole, you know, freedom community that we've developed since COVID, where we're trying to find people with like-minded skills and abilities and don't want to be stuck in any lockdowns. And he just happened to love the product as well and started helping me build a business and boom, and a very, very short amount of time, we created our company called Cultivated Mind, and it has been a wild ride ever since, honestly. I've been really surprised at how accepting people are to mushrooms now, because we did kind of try to do something similar like 3 years ago, and people weren't really into it, but suddenly in the last like year and a half, there's been like this sort of big like awakening to mushrooms.
Yeah, there is.
And the reviews that we get from people have been great. Like, our immune blend, for example, there have been several women that have come to us and said that it's really helped with their bloating and their digestion. They were having a lot of pain, they were having a lot of constipation, things like that. And after about a week and a half of chaga, turkey tail, maitake, shiitake, and reishi, yeah, their digestive systems have totally changed. Their stomachs have flattened out. They don't have pain anymore. They're able to go to the bathroom regularly. And just the amount of things that have been happening have been blowing my mind, because when I got into this originally, I'm like, okay, I know this worked for Jen. This kind of worked for my mom. Is this going to work for the mass public though? But the reception has just been wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah. No side effects. They're very safe. The one thing I've been was amazed by this, and the way I designed it to pretty much be mushrooms. We were originally doing some ashwagandha, but there are side effects with ashwagandha. And as we found out doing more research with mushrooms, there are hardly any side effects at all. They don't interact with medications. They don't toxify the liver. The only one that has a slight side effect would be the chaga. If you do excessive amounts of chaga, it can lead to kidney stones. Yeah. So if you're prone to kidney stones, then I would probably avoid taking chaga. Definitely don't take like huge amounts of it. You know, besides that, very safe and amazing reviews.
So can you talk about maybe the difference between using mushrooms medicinally and culinarily? Because I you know, based on some of the things y'all said at the beginning and things that I know, I'm assuming that like when I take lion's mane and cook it into this beautiful steak-like thing and it's delicious, or push it to where it kind of tastes like crab meat, it's delicious, and yeah, it probably has benefits, but it probably doesn't have the same benefits as something that is specifically prepared for medicinal use.
So you are going to get a large amount of the benefits from it, actually. What's important is that you cook your mushrooms if you're going to do things culinarily. If you're going to do maitake, shiitake, or lion's mane, which these are the edible ones, then you need to break the cells down, because the cells actually are very like hard shells. They have this chitin, and it actually traps the medicine inside the cell walls. So if I just eat a raw lion's mane, or if I just eat a raw shiitake, I don't get a whole lot of the benefits from it. It actually will just pass through your body, because it's trapped in there. So you want to like break the cells open by heating it. The heat process will help to do that. What we do here is we actually we dry them, and then we soak them in alcohol. And we let that sit for sometimes 2 weeks, depends on the mushroom. And then we also use, hot water, but not really hot. We technically use an ultrasonic machine to do like a physical breaking of the cells, because I don't want to get mine too hot. When you get things hot, you end up destroying compounds. You can hurt the trehalose. You can hurt ergothionine, because they have lower temperatures than, let's say, the beta glutamines, which comes in most other mushroom products. So we do ours at a lower temperature. But it is important that you do that slight process, because a raw mushroom, like I said, is just going to get trapped up in your body.
Yeah, and some are actually somewhat toxic or can cause problems if they're not cooked. I've heard that about things like shiitake. I don't know if it's true or not, but I've heard don't eat raw shiitake.
So there are fructans in there. It's something that some people can get ill from. It can upset their stomach. So yeah, you want to cook it, or you want to dry it. Actually, if you dry your shiitake, it will eliminate a lot of the fructans as well. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, I just want to kind of point out for people that you might get a lot of benefit from eating them, but if you want the medicinal benefits, things like tinctures and stuff may be better. And I mean, we're just not going to eat mushrooms every day. Most people,
no.
Anyway. Now, you know, my favorites are like lion's mane, king oysters, and maitake. They're all just fantastic mushrooms. Absolutely. They're also expensive.
Yes, they are. Raw fresh mushrooms are expensive compared to the extracts. And when you think about how much you're getting, like in the long run, yes.
Like, yeah, you know, you can make a lion's mane taste like steak. And yeah, I can buy a USDA prime steak for less ounce for ounce by the time it's done being cooked. I'm not a vegan, so I'm not trying to do that. I just know it tastes good that way. I'm not trying to make a trick here or anything. But I guess the good news is lion's mane and many of the oysters are actually really easy to grow at home.
Yes. Yeah, oysters, super simple. You can really do that outdoors even. You know, just hang it in some bags with some shade, and oyster takes over real fast. Lion's mane is a little bit more tricky. It actually prefers a certain climate.
Yeah.
It wants more humidity, and it doesn't want to be too hot.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be able to do that out lion's mane outdoors here in Houston. It would just die.
I've actually been thinking about setting up like a Martha tent. We get a lot more environmental control and things like that. Because king oyster is like one of the greatest mushrooms in the world, but it's a little picky trying to do it without real control. But I mean, it tastes like scallops if you do it right. I think that's pretty cool to be able to take waste material around your house, a little bit of mycelium, and basically make scallops. I'm a vegan, but because I just think that's cool.
It's cool.
It's relatively simple to do. And you can, like I said, you can make a very expensive meal with like small ingredients. Just get an inoculum and fill out some coffee grinds or maybe some straw or something, and you could produce a whole lot.
Yeah, and there are easy ones. I've got like my fourth flush of blue oyster going now off of nothing but store-bought mushroom stems.
Nice. Oh, that's awesome.
Coffee grinds, a little bit of biochar, and some sawdust spawn that's made from pellets, hardwood fuel. I mean, the same shit I put in my grill.
I love it.
Literally, like, just about half and half with coffee grinds, because it turned out it worked better that way.
Okay.
You know, I think maybe because it has different particles. I don't know.
They like a little more diversity of food sources sometimes. Each one has its own little recipe that it likes. So play around with it. You'd be surprised what happens, how it changes.
A lot of times when people hear mushrooms as medicine, they think, you know, TCM, traditional Chinese medicine. But there's a lot of modern real research that actually supports all this, isn't there?
Yeah, so there is. A lot of it comes from Asia. A lot of it's coming from Japan. A lot of it's coming from China, where, of course, we have ancient Ayurvedic medicine, where these originated. You have, you know, 5,000-year-old or 1,000-year-old texts that actually mention mushrooms in them. So something that has been around for a long time. Of course, here in the States, we don't study for it. Why? Well, because that would hurt the pharmaceutical industry. It would take money out of their pockets again. So when you go looking for this research, it's going to be in China, it's going to be in Japan, and there's a gentleman who actually wrote a really interesting book. His name is Robert Rogers, and his book is called Medicinal Mushrooms, the Human Clinical Trials, or the Human Clinical Trials of Medicinal Mushrooms. And he lists a massive textbook of references that you can look up and go find the actual human clinical trials, not petri dishes, not in vitro studies. They did this on people, and the wide range of different debilities, from diabetes to cancer to ED. You know, mushrooms have this massive list of things that they actually do treatments for, from anxiety to depression to, you know, gut biome support. If I was to list it out, I mean, the list would be massive. It would go from like above my head, like to the ground, because they are what are called adaptogens. And they take your body and they move it into the parameters that it's supposed to be. They don't force your body into a certain direction. They look at where you're at, and if your immune system needs a boost, then it can give it a boost. But if you have a hyperactive immune system, which you find this actually in the book, they did it was a study on maitake, shiitake, and reishi, and this had an immunomodulating effect, meaning that if you had a hyperactive immune system, if you had something that was attacking your own body, it actually did the opposite and calmed your system down. So it's one of the only things in nature that can do this. I don't think there's a pharmaceutical.
There is not.
That can do that.
Everything in pharmacy takes you one way or the other, which is funny because everything in pharmacy is also made from something in nature. Like, we're just mimicking something that we found in nature, but they don't have the ability to balance anything. It's like when you take chemo, it just suppresses you, you know? It's not going to give you what you need. It's just always going to bring you down. So, yeah.
And this research reminded me about how you had that meeting where they were going to do natural medicines, but they decided not to.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, yeah. So we were looking at partnering with a company. They had approached us. And we were going to partner with them, and they were more like holistic, natural things. And in the end, we, like I said, when you're in sales, you go to a different company meeting than everybody else goes to, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we go to this meeting, and there's this number on this piece of paper, and they're like, this is what we're going to lose revenue-wise if we go with this company. And they said, because with the drugs that we have right now, we get to treat with the drug, and then we also get to treat all the side effects. And these natural things don't have all these side effects. And so that was the meeting where I was like, I don't think I can do this anymore, you know? And I even spoke up in the meeting, and I was like, this is not putting the patient first. Like, we've always we take pride in that because we set ourselves apart as compounders and not just big pharma. And my boss looked at me and said, we need the revenue. Like, don't you like the apartment you live in? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And I mean, he has a point, and we do need to make revenue.
Yeah.
But the fact that we can't take on a natural not even a supplement, but a natural ingredient that will heal people, and we're so concerned that we won't make enough revenue, it just really, that was like my breaking point. And I couldn't.
And they said
the reason that we didn't take it on, they told the whole company, the reason we didn't want to do this was because we wanted to only stick with things that are FDA approved. Well, that's not real, because we had a supplement line and none of them are FDA approved.
Yeah. Right. There's always some bullshit you can drum up to claim you're doing the right thing when you absolutely know you're doing the wrong thing. And again, the pattern repeats. When I worked for Fluke and we did computer test equipment, we'd have a new piece of equipment come out and they're like, yeah, we need to not release this till next year. Well, why? Well, it's going to cannibalize sales of our existing product. Oh, you mean the one that's going to be defunct by the end of the year? Yeah, but people are buying it, so we don't.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'm carrying a quota for the product you won't let me sell. Well, yeah, but you can make it up with the other product. You mean the one that I shouldn't sell my customer, I'm going to have to go back to next year and tell them they need to buy this now because this no longer meets the standard that we wrote as a member of the standard committee that we control.
Right. Well, then that, now you just lost that customer, too, because they're upset with you, you know?
No, by then we had a functional monopoly on the market.
Well, there you go.
And then we would just go an architect who was designing a building and had a consultant working with him to design the telco, and then we would write our product into the spec.
Wow. There
I mean,
you go.
It's the same. That's why I see it everywhere, because it's
same,
the same.
Yeah.
It seems so divorced, like computer test equipment versus pharmaceuticals, but it's the same model. I learned this. I had a good friend of the family. This guy's name was Byron, and he did basically the same job I did for Fluke for Mattel Toys. Now, that seems pretty different, right? I'm selling $6,000 fiber optics equipment. He's selling Barbie dolls. But our exact job descriptions and what we did and our meetings and how we managed our reps and how we approached gaining retail market share, et cetera, merchandising, it was all the same. I'm just selling through Gray Bar and Anixter, and he's selling through Toys R Us. I mean, it's the same freaking thing everywhere. And once you see it, you can't not see it. You're like, oh, there it is again.
Yeah.
To do that trick. We invented that trick, you know? Like the spec in trick. That's as old as it gets. You just find the guy that does the spec, and then you go take them out to eat and feed them $1,000 worth of food, and you get them drunk and he specs in your equipment. That's just how it's done. And I'm sure the worse happens in pharma. There's more money. I had to ship a box bigger than this for $6,000. You can put $50 million worth of pharmaceutical crap in that same box, right? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, it was wild. Like when I was in sales, on the sales team, we would travel all over the United States, and you have that company credit card, and they tell you, you wine them, you dine them, you do whatever it takes to get them to sign that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just, there's no limit.
I would get calls, you didn't spend enough of your entertainment budget this quarter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. Our entertainment budget's on our own dinners, actually.
So, can we talk about more about how we can create local healthy solutions to the bad food, the bad advice? We've hit the problem pretty hard today. Some things people can actually do for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there are some great solutions. We certainly need to get back to smaller farms first, and this definitely goes to finding the regenerative farm, finding the organic farm, and helping them grow, starting your own. It's going to take a year or two. I've already been looking. I've found some interesting places already. I've got actually a regenerative milk farm that's in the in my vicinity. And I'm going to partner with him. I'm going to partner with some other organic farms. And we're going to try to get like a local food distribution network going to where I've vetted every single farm and I've gone there and I've made sure that they're doing all the proper procedures. And it's not just me finding some person that's getting it from a distributor that's getting it from Mexico. You know, it's going to take the due diligence of the distributor to make sure that the food is coming from a regenerative place. And then once we do that, we can create our own local distribution community of food. A nationwide system's not going to work. Mine's going to essentially be limited to just the Houston area. And we're going to get us a nice truck. We're going to fill it with farm fresh produce and meat and milk. And we're going to create our own grocery store, our own little mobile grocery store. So anybody can do this. Anyone can just start looking around for farms, create those relationships, find the people who are growing the food, and then work a deal with them on how much you want to pay for it and get the truck and start your own little business. I think this is something that anybody can do. Or you're the farmer and just start your journey as the farmer and find the person who is doing the distribution so you have someone to sell to. Because finding someone to sell to is one of the most important parts of being a farmer. You can grow the food all day, but if you have no way to get rid of it, you know, it's all just going to rot like in your field. So start creating these networks of local conscious farmers and distributors. Start creating that community. Start getting people together. We're going to do some classes as well on farming. Occasionally I do a K&F class or a Genome class, and that's also part of the networking. It's not just, hey, come to a class. No, I want to know who you are. I want to know where your farm is. I want to know where you're at in your stage, and then maybe even talk to you in the future about getting your produce. You know, when you stay in contact. But these are networking events to have people come together, and then from there you create the community, you create the solution, you create the business, and it's important to keep it all connected.
Yeah, I think that one of the things I try to tell people is I always show these people it's kind of a form of the toolbox fallacy. I'm going to grow this, and then I'm going to sell it. It's like,
no.
Well, you sell it before you produce it, or produce a thing and sell it as kind of a side hustle startup. Build a customer base and then ask your customers, what else could I sell you? And if they tell you something and you're like, that would take some real effort to ramp up production, find it. And then make it be, I got a customer base, you make a thing.
Yes.
How many of your things can you supply me a month into my customer base of 150 mm-hmm. customers, and then build a catalog of business where you're maybe producing one or two things, but you're collecting from other local producers or don't even produce anything. Like there's a shitload of people that know how to sell and people that know how to grow, and they need each other.
That's the distributors. Yeah, the distributors, you develop those relationships, you find the produce, and then you get it to the people. That's its own business itself. Just going to the farm, picking it up, and getting it to the person is its own business.
People like packages. So if you could tell somebody, like, once a week you get 2 pounds of grass-fed ground beef, a pound of various mushrooms, and, you know, maybe a dozen duck eggs, and a couple clamshells of microgreens, and, you know, something like that, to where maybe it changes a little bit, but there's a basic weekly or biweekly package. Mm-hmm. That's actually easy to sell, especially when you already have a relationship. Like, we have retail customers for our duck eggs. We sell them $12 a dozen now. Mm-hmm. They're sold before they come out of the duck's butt.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Nice. Anybody that will drive here, and some people are driving 45 minutes to an hour to pick up 4 dozen duck eggs at $12 a dozen, is not the kind of person that says, well, those microgreens are too expensive.
Right.
It's not that person. They're a person that has a different priority list. Mm-hmm. And so what I would say is, instead of like making a thing and then trying to sell it to your customers, talk to your customers first and find out what they're interested in. Mm-hmm. And again, if you can reach out and pull another product without producing it and throw a little margin on it, you're building something for multiples. You'll never do everything. There's no way you're going to do everything.
No, no. And a good way to build a customer base, I actually used to do this when I was working in a resale. We would go buy people's garage sales and then turn around and flip them and basically sell their garage sale to other people. Well, yep. We used to do pop-ups. So we would just pop up randomly on a corner, street corner somewhere. We're technically not supposed to be there. But you get a few sales in, you get customers, and then you move somewhere else. So you can start finding a relationship with this by just popping up a sign in the middle of Home Depot somewhere. Hey, eggs for sale.
Yeah.
Hey, here's my phone number. You want more eggs? Give me a call. And you don't have to go back to that spot. You just got yourself a customer.
Yep.
No.
Yeah, I like that better. Farmer markets, because you guys know as well as I do, farmer market in Texas it's a national embarrassment, I feel, how bad our farmer's market regulations are here.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
For California, you go to a farmer's market in California, and for all the problems in California, it's amazing.
Hmm.
And it is just a more difficult thing. Like, there's two things we don't have in Texas we should. A good food truck scene and a good farmer market scene. Those things should not be a problem in this state, but they are. I talk to people that run them, and I understand the problems with them. They're highly regulated compared to other places. Montana's another place. You go to a farmer's market in Montana, and it's like food nirvana. Children skipping through the field, throwing freaking fresh food at people. And here, you know, it's not terrible. It's just not good.
No,
house to put it.
The good ones are far and few between. I think we got lucky with a couple of ours.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. And there may be some local carve outs that I'm not aware of. I'll tell you that DFW is a terrible place for farmers markets. It's just.
Huh. Okay.
I'm not saying they're terrible. I'm saying that when you compare them to other places, you feel they're lacking. There's a pretty good one in Bastrop, but it's. I don't know, maybe it has something to do with supply too. Like, we just don't have as many people growing, I think, in Texas as we do in some other places.
Yeah.
Small scale, true commercial farming, and that might hurt it as well.
Well, that's a big part of the solution thing, is we do need more farms.
Yeah.
You know, the farmer has been just beaten up over the years, and it's become very difficult for them to even make money. It's a lot of work. I mean, being a farmer is not easy. You're constantly doing something. You don't get a chance for a vacation. I did 7 years of farming straight. I never got a vacation the entire time. You just work every single day, because you don't get it. You can't leave. Like, the system requires, you know, your presence to be there. I think that's obviously with conventional agriculture. If you get into it deep, you get into making your own fertilizers, you get into making your own composting, you're saving a lot of money, you're saving a little bit of time. We can make a more efficient farm for sure.
Yeah. You guys had a mass die-off of bees. Like, 60% of all bee colonies are lost across the U.S. in 2024. There seems to be some connection to some of the stuff y'all do to maybe that. Do you got any insight on that? Because this is a huge loss nationwide.
Yeah. This last year was devastating for bees. I'm surprised it didn't hit us down here more. It was more a little bit north of us.
Yeah.
But we're pretty sure that it is because of all of the pesticide sprays, because all the pesticides and herbicide sprays that are spraying all over the fields. And every year these spray amounts go up and up and up. And this leads to this massive dysbiosis of our soil, of our environment. And the bees, they really need a healthy microbiome. The microbiome keeps pests and diseases off of their bodies. For example, there's a fungus, I think it's called Metarhizium, but it actually kills the parasites, those little those mites, those bee mites, but it won't hurt the bee itself. So all of these chemicals that we're spraying constantly has destroyed the microbiome of our soils, of our lands, and then now there's nothing to form that symbiotic relationship with the bees to help protect them from diseases and parasites and things like that. So we're starting to see like a breakdown of some of our most important systems, like our insects. Our insect population has been decimated over the last 15 years, like 20 years. The amounts of bugs, I mean, think about it. When you were a kid and you drove across town, just drove across town, you had to clean your windshield.
Yeah.
You know, with the amount of bugs.
I'm thinking back, I wasn't even a kid. I was in my 20s when I moved to Texas. And as I'm driving through like Missouri and Oklahoma and all coming down here from Pennsylvania, there were points I'd drive 5 or 6 miles and I had to like find a gas station because the squirty juice wasn't enough. And you needed a squeegee because of the amount of insects driving through farm country. There was like a paint. You couldn't see anymore.
Right.
And remember everybody used to buy for a pickup truck, especially the days of the square body trucks that look much better than what we have today, in my opinion. They were so aerodynamically inferior that they funneled insects into your windshield. Industry and bug deflectors. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen a bug deflector on a pickup truck in 15 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because there's no need for it. You go across the entire state and you don't even have to clean your windshield anymore.
Yeah.
These are very important aspects to our environment that we really need to start looking at and changing, because it's the basis of our food chain. You know, and these are kind of like canaries in the coal mine of we need to fix our systems before the system, you know, collapses in on us. You know, that's why changing to Korean natural farming, changing to doing IMOs, changing to do compost and microbial inoculations that form these symbiotic relationships that improve health, that improve secondary metabolites in plants. You can't have a healthy plant without bacteria and fungus. It will reach a certain level of health and then it'll just stop. It cannot perform its secondary metabolites without bacteria and fungus being present in the soil. So we need to get back to a more natural method, a more natural system. And we're seeing it all around us.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you tell people a little bit about your company and the stuff that you offer?
Yeah, so we do powdered extracts. So we take whole fruiting body mushrooms. So I've got some lion's mane right here. Like, we grow it and then we dry it just to store it. And then we do an alcohol extraction. And then we do the warm water, not hot, warm water ultrasonic extraction. And then we take that solution and we re-dry it back into a powder because – if you take a tincture, a lot of people don't like the taste of tinctures. I think the first time we ever got one, we did it like twice. It was so bitter and gross, we just ended up throwing it out. You know, it's the taste is not there. So when you put them in a powder, and then Jen, with Jen's help of pharmacy, she said we should put it in a capsule. So we capsule it as well, so you don't have to taste anything, you don't have to experience anything, you don't have to have an extra drink or something to mix it in. We've also found that when you do a powdered mushroom, it seems to have a better effect on the gut biome. When you're taking the liquid tinctures, a lot of it gets absorbed into the body before it ever gets down to your large intestine. Okay. And we found that when you have that powder, it carries a substance all the way down through your digestive system. And that's where we're getting a lot of the microbial growth, beneficial microbial growth, and suppression of bad microbes as well. The other day I was having some stomach issues because I just drank way too much dairy and like threw my whole system off. I got some stomach bug. And if normally you would take something to grow out the beneficial bacteria, it would also grow out the bad bacteria as well, but not mushrooms. Mushrooms suppress the bad stuff and grow out the good stuff. So I was taking my own lion's mane to help fix my gut biome, and it was taking a lot of the pain away. So doing an extract in a powder makes it very potent as well, because when you're getting it in a tincture, you don't know what that dilution rate is. That dilution rate they could have put a bunch of extra water and a bunch of extra alcohol in there, and you have a very weak substance, whereas with it's a powder, it can only get so diluted without having you put another powder in there to dilute it out, and we don't do other powders. It's 100% mushrooms. Other companies do like anti-caking agents to keep it from getting clogged up in the machine and everything, but yeah. We don't do any of that. We don't do microcrystalline cellulose and sodium dioxide and all these other things, extra stuff that really is not going to be good for your body. And yeah, we've had some amazing results, amazing stuff from athletes as well. And
there might be some surface area level thing going on too with a very fine powder. And you take that in a capsule, and as it enters the intestines, you have a massive surface area then for the body's microbes to interact with.
Mm-hmm.
Versus if it were a tincture, okay, yeah, you get it in your body, but it doesn't have that surface area because it's going to spread out throughout the gut biome at that point.
Right, right. Maybe treating it.
I never thought of that, but it makes sense.
Right, sort of treating it like if it was a biochar. Right, yeah. You have like a physical substance there for the bacteria to live and feed off of. Yeah,
pattern recognition comes back, and this time for the win instead of right. Like, so tell people how they can get to your website, and I'll make sure your link tree and your website and all are in the show notes today.
Awesome, thank you. Yeah, so you can go to cultivated-mind.com. There's a dash in between cultivated mind, and yeah, we've got dog treats as well. We make a really healthy dog treat. We jam pack it full of nutrition because all the dog food that you have in the stores is just terrible for your dogs. You shouldn't be just feeding them that. They need to actually supplement other things. So we, our mother-in-law, Jen's mom, has a chicken farm. So we put the pasture-raised eggs from the chicken farm and beef liver and Alaskan salmon oil and took out all the grain. So it's a really healthy mushroom treat. It has 6 of our medicinal mushrooms in there as well. So this goes back to mushrooms being safe for everyone, safe for people, safe for dogs. You know, we started the company and Cultivated Mind just happened to pop in my head randomly one day, and that's how we started the name, and I thought it fit really perfect. And that's what we do, grow mushrooms and heal people, and the journey has been amazing.
Well, I'll let you get back at it, but if you don't mind, maybe we could do some Q&A with the audience first here.
Yeah.
I got a bunch of questions, and most of them are from one person, but they're good, so we'll allow that. Jeff T., do you know what kind of low-cost mushroom spores help turn my wood chip piles into compost? Right now, it's taking 3 or 4 years. Now, there's more than one way to do that, Jeff, but a mushroom can help you.
Right. So what you want to do is you don't want to spend hardly anything. You want to go make IMO. You want to take some rice, some white rice, and you want to al dente boil it to where it's just sort of soft, but still kind of sort of hard. And then you're going to put this into a box or a basket, and you're going to go find a really healthy area in the woods that has been totally untouched as long as possible. And you're going to leave this in the woods covered so that rain can't get on it for about 3 to 5 days, depending on the temperature. And then mold is going to grow on this rice. And you're going to want to mostly be white. If it's like a bunch of different greens and purples and reds and things like that, that might not even be the best collection. And then take that and mix that into your wood chips immediately. Like as soon as you get it, mix in your wood chips. And you just inoculated it with mushrooms. You just inoculated it with fungus. Mm-hmm. And that was a cheapest, freest fungus that you could find to do.
30 cents worth of rice.
Yep. There you go. Yeah, you don't need to buy mushrooms. You can go get mushrooms from the forest for free.
And I also wonder, like, it might have to do something with how much biological activity there's here, but my wood chips are just rife with mycelium. That's part of why I use them in my bioreactor. I mean, you have to literally break them apart when you add them to the bioreactor because they're just netted together with mycelium. So.
Yep.
He might be in an even drier climate than mine because if I go out to my wood chip pile in July, that's not the case anymore. It's
right.
Right.
You need to maintain a certain moisture level or they will dry out and the fungus will die. Yeah. So it has to maintain a certain moisture level. Not too wet, not too dry.
If you have lots of wood chips and you mix them with like 15% greens in a bioreactor, it'll take care of your problem too. There's a lot of ways to come at this.
Yeah.
My question for you, like you said, oysters would kill my nematodes, and okay, fine, we killed them in that one bioreactor, and it'll work out long term, so that's fine. It's a long term product anyway. But are there mushrooms you would recommend for that that are also edibles? Like the patty straw seemed like a really good play because it'll fruit at like 95 degrees, so that makes sense for my climate. But like, are there any mushrooms that you think would be good in the cap of a bioreactor?
I don't have any particular species that would necessarily be beneficial. Again, I always go back to indigenous microorganisms.
Okay.
Because your soil is already attuned to that environment. So you're going to want to try and keep your collections as local as possible.
Yeah. I'm looking at more culinarily, though. Like, if it can produce something while it's happening, that makes people more likely
to be I see what you mean.
Patient, right? Like, I've done King Straff, and I think what happens with that, the earthworms in there love the King Strafforia mycelium so much. It works from a breakdown, but you don't really get any fruit set out of it because what will happen is as the King Strafforia mycelium infiltrates, the worms just explode, like, because they go through a cycle when you first introduce them, they explode and then they begin to decline as they've consumed a lot of the stuff that they want to eat in there. And then all of a sudden when you infuse King Strafforia, like about 5 weeks later, if you pull back the wood chips, it looks like a bait shop.
Okay.
So I have to think that they particularly like to eat that or
sure.
some interaction with King Strafforia, which is probably why they're such a good garden mushroom. But like I said, I'm doing the patty straw. This is the first time I ever did it. I've also looked at doing some other things, and this slipped in my head right now, some of the other ones I've thought of doing. But oysters, just you get a result. Like
right.
if you take a pound of sawdust spawn of like a blue oyster, a golden oyster, pink oyster, 6 weeks later, there's freaking mushrooms all over the top of the bioreactor.
Yeah, they're super simple. Yes, oyster is definitely going to be the really easy one that's going to grow in almost every climate. What I would say is check out your climate and then try to compare that to a certain mushroom, an edible mushroom.
Nice.
If you live in an area where shiitake grows naturally, then maybe you could inoculate your wood chips with shiitake and get something out of it. Down here where we're at, it's pretty tough. You know, we get a lot of heat, so I think oyster is pretty much the only one besides. There are some medicinal ones, like we grow reishi and turkey tail out here naturally. I just walk in the woods and I can find it.
Okay.
So if you're looking for maybe even a medicinal one as well, those actually might be easier to grow than an edible mushroom, besides oyster, of course.
The other one I was considering, and I haven't tried yet, is shaggy mane. I think that might work in that environment, too. But, again, I'm just trying to get people to be patient with their damn compost. And, you know, if you can get some stuff out of it while it's composting, maybe you'll chill out and stop telling me you don't want to wait 12 months. I'm using it like 18 months at this point. Because once you get it to where you're building bioreactors, you know, the same time every year, you start to end up with a surplus. And then the longer it's like, what's the other stuff that you guys use? Fermented plant juice. Like the longer you age it, the better it gets, you know? Mm-hmm. So it stops being a problem. How do you tell which mushroom supplements, by the way, Jeff, that's the kind of witch that flies on a broom, which supplements are real and which are full of filters like Vitamin Industries? Buy from somebody who does it right.
So, yeah, you have to do your own research. You're going to have to go into the fine details of the product. Sometimes they don't put it on the back of the bottle, and you might have to go to the website and look up their documentation and make sure it says either 100% mushrooms or it says no fillers, no anti-caking agents, no grain. You know, there's a bit of back and forth on grain. But, just make sure you look at the label. And you don't see things like microcrystalline cellulose. You don't see sodium dioxide, you know, things like that in there. Because those come from large industrial mushroom companies where they sell wholesale to companies. And then they just brand it, stick it in a bottle, and then send it out.
I mean, you're probably – I'm not just pimping these guys. You're probably better off, though, buying from somebody like this. Whether it's them or some other small-scale producer, there's room for 1,000 companies this size. There's room for 10,000 companies this size. Yeah. And if we all started buying from local or small companies, then these big corporations wouldn't be as much of a problem anymore, because they have two choices then. Go into something else or fix their shit. Mm-hmm. And most of them aren't going to fix their shit, so that makes it a pretty comfortable position to be a small player.
Right. And I think it's also important that you make sure when you're buying a mushroom supplement that it is local. And when I say local, I mean you don't need it to be coming from outside of your country, because things have to sit in customs. When they sit in customs, they can be there for up to 2 years. And like the efficacy of like if just cordyceps, the half-life is 6 months. And so you, like my first round of cordyceps I bought offline, and it was just for my personal use. But then when we started growing our own, and I was taking it at dinner time, I had no problem. And then we start growing our own, and Sean gives me this capsule to test out one night at dinner, and then I'm up till 3:30 in the morning decorating for Christmas, because
the energy bounce, right?
Yeah. So it makes a really big difference when it is local, when it is fresh, and like everything that we sell, like we have processed this month, like it is as fresh as it's going to get. Mm-hmm. And if you can find other companies in your area that are doing that, and that will be the most beneficial.
Yeah. Go to your local farmer's market where they're growing their own lion's mane, their own reishi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Jeff also is asking, are there specific mushrooms that make a lot of sense to eat for health benefits? And I'm back to lion's mane. It's delicious. And king oyster is delicious. And maitake is delicious. And I like all of them, but any of it.
So all mushrooms are beneficial. All mushrooms will have a beneficial effect on your immune system. Even the little like button ones that you find at the grocery store, they actually have high amounts of beta glutamines in them. And like I said, you're going to want to cook them down so that you can get the medicine out of the mushroom. Anytime you can get any kind of mushrooms in your system, it's definitely going to be beneficial. They have compounds in them that you can't find in other plants and animals, like that are very specific to just mushrooms.
I mean, they are the third kingdom, right? They're their own thing. They're not a plant. They're not an animal. It's there's something else.
Something in between. Yeah.
And I would have to agree with you, like for myself, because my ongoing theme of my life has been that I have an issue with my brain, right? Whether that's mental health, whether it's brain fog, you name it. But nothing has made me feel more confident and like more whole as when I'm eating lion's mane mushroom or taking the supplement. It made me more confident. I can go and talk to people. I can sit here and have this conversation with you and not be searching for my words constantly and like trying to figure out what I want to say. It just flows, and it's been such a change, and I'm so grateful that I have that, and it's just readily available. It's incredible.
We got one more from Tyler. Was wondering about chaga oxalic acid. Does it cook out like the OA and greens, or is it a different form?
I'm not 100% sure on that, but from what I saw when I looked at the side effects, they were using a powdered extract, but they were taking like large doses. They were doing like 1 to 2 tablespoons a day in this. So I'm actually not 100% sure if you could cook that out. I'm sure I'd have to research that actually.
Okay. I don't know is always a fair answer. It's always a better answer than faking it. So
I'm
not really sure that. I know that people worry about that a lot more than I do, but maybe it's because I have no sensitivity to it.
If you don't have kidney problems, then the chaga is not going to be detrimental to you. It's just usually people have some sort of kidney failure, or if you're taking very large doses every day for like months, that you can start developing.
All right, man. Well, guys, I really appreciate you being with us today. Throw out that website one more time. Let know people what they can find there.
Yeah, it was cultivated-mind or cultivated-mind.com. Yeah, we've got mushroom extracts and powders. They're in specific blends. So one for your brain. There's one for that gives you a bunch of energy. It's also for people who work out. It's technically a pre-workout, but very healthy. And then we have our Immune Renew, which has been great for autoimmune conditions like hormone imbalances, a bunch of digestion stuff like gut, constipation, gas, bloating. And then, of course, stuff for dogs because, hey, mushrooms for everyone. They're very safe and very healthy for kids, dogs, animals, people. Yeah. That's probably the reason we even do this is because if there were any detrimental effects, I wouldn't want to be associated with it.
No, no. And I, like you say, all of them are 100% mushrooms except the doggy ones because we've got to get the doggy to eat its little beef liver and some pasture-raised eggs and some Alaskan salmon oil in there so that the dog will happily eat it because as much as we like mushrooms, I find that my dogs don't.
No.
Fly with me. They don't need them. I'll eat them. Just certain things dogs don't tend to really want to eat and saute. Yeah. Put enough butter on them, they'll eat them. But I like the dog treat stuff. And hey, says, how about mushrooms for cats? Break the dog treat in half to give it to the cat. It'll be all
they're
right.
Healthy. They're safe for the cats, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, guys, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Jack.
I'm sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead.
I said thank you for having us.
All right, man. Thanks for being here, guys. All right, real quick there, I want to just say as we wrap up, if you want to help us out and support the work that we do, one of the things you can do is do your online shopping. Where, tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day is the Vivor rechargeable LED headlamps. I don't know a better deal than this on a headlamp. They are incredibly bright. They just work. Vivor is one of those companies like half of what they make is amazing and half of it is got some issues. This is the one that's amazing. Rechargeable, $9 a piece because they sell in a two-pack for $18. They fit on your head. They light things up either with a spotlight or a wideband LED. They have a motion sensor where you can turn them on and off with a wave of your hand. And they're inexpensive as all get out. They're really hard to beat. I haven't found a product that actually competes with this one on any meaningful level. And they do have a very long life of their battery. I have a set that I've been using now for 2 years. When I went up to Nicole Sauce's workshop, there were several people using them, so they were very happy with them. I've sold hundreds of these, and I've not had a complaint. That's one of the most telling endorsements for me. When I try something, I think it's good, I recommend it, a bunch of people buy it, and then nobody bitches about it. I know I've made a good call, so check them out again, the Vivor rechargeable LED headlamps. Also consider, if you haven't done so yet, picking up a copy of my book, Laws of Life. It's still doing very well on Amazon, orders coming in every day for it. The feedback has been exceptional, and if you've started reading it enough that you have formed an opinion on the quality of the material, please consider writing a review for us on Amazon. That really helps us show up more in the research results, get more association with other books and other authors, and reach that larger audience. I wrote the book for y'all, but I also wrote the book to help everybody and bring more people into the TSP community. If I didn't think we could reach a wider audience with it, I wouldn't have put the effort into writing the book. I didn't want to become an author just to become an author. I wanted to give you, a lot of y'all have asked for something like that because you can't get a person to sit down and listen to a podcast, but maybe they'll read a book. But I also wanted to reach people that I wouldn't otherwise reach. So if you can help me out with a review, even if you think it sucks, total reviews are more important than how many of them are 5-star. But if you really like it, give us 5 stars. Give us a review. I'll catch you guys tomorrow with, you know what's coming, the Expert Counsel Q&A show for the week. And then Friday, we'll have a Friday flashback. And next week, we'll do it all over again. We are back to regular scheduled programming after some interruptions there. Another thing, if you'd be interested, maybe in going on a hunt with me up in Oklahoma, I'm talking to someone up there. It's more Texas than Oklahoma. It's just across the border, a bit of the Red River. It would be a hog hunt, and I'm not sure what time of year it would be yet, but it's a really, really cool lodge. Meals included type of thing, really great, like a 3-day getaway with the boys type of thing. Gals welcome to, of course, and shoot some pigs and take some meat home. And be some options there for exotics as well, like rams and some other stuff. That would be on a case-by-case pay-as-you-go basis for those. But the hunt itself for a hog and the experience and being with everybody would be about $800. I'm working and negotiating that, but it's probably going to be in that range. It'd be a hell of a lot of fun. If you'd be interested in that, just send me an email, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com with TSPC hunting in the subject line. Don't worry about rushing that, or it's going to come up really quick. This will be something that would probably be set out at least a few months, maybe into the winter months or something like that of this year, early next year. But it just looks like a really cool thing that maybe we turn into an annual getaway for the community. And I wanted to gauge the interest before I promise this guy that I can do too much. Thanks a lot again for tuning in. Take care, and I'll catch you tomorrow with that Expert Counsel show.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.